This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
You know it's coming. I know it's coming. So I'm just going to go ahead and say it. A Greece update on the program today. A quick one, though, I promise. Also, the Secretary of Commerce and our series, First Jobs. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Wednesday, July the 1st. Glad you could be with us, everybody. We are not going to do an official Greece story today, but we do, I think, have kind of a fiduciary duty to keep you all up to speed on the global economy crisis of the moment. So here goes.
We told you yesterday that right before a deadline to repay the IMF 1.6 billion euros, Greek Prime Minister Alexis Tsipras asked his creditors for a quick loan to let him pay yesterday's balance due. That went nowhere, so the payment was missed. They are now in arrears. And then, this morning, Tsipras sent the Europeans and the IMF a letter saying he is ready to make a deal on the Eurozone's most recent proposal with only a couple of conditions. German Chancellor Angela Merkel said thanks, but no thanks, and besides, there's no proposal on the table anymore, she said, for Athens to agree to accept, because there is going to be that referendum this coming Sunday. And then, Tsipras went on Greek TV this afternoon, urging voters to back him up on the referendum and vote no, meaning they reject Europe's conditions, but not repeat not, meaning that they want to leave the Eurozone. So, as it stands now, nothing at all is going to happen until that vote on Sunday.
And two more quick things before we move along. First of all, should you be curious, we have set up a website to give you the answer to the question we know you have been asking. Check it out. IsGreeceSolventYet.com. I could give you a hint, but I'm not going to. Also, remember yesterday I told you about that Indiegogo crowdfunding project to take care of the Greek bailout? It is up to, listen to this, 1.1 million euros as of right now. If you contribute 3 euros, the guy in London who set it up will get you a postcard of Prime Minister Tsipras, which is pretty good. All right, moving on. President Obama took a page from the Strike Why the Iron is Hot School of Politicking today. After last week's Supreme Court ruling upholding the Affordable Care Act, the president flew out to Nashville, Tennessee, to try to add to the list of states that have agreed to expand Medicaid under the ACA. As I said, politicking for sure. Also, though, some good old-fashioned salesmanship. From the health desk at WHYY in Philadelphia, Marketplace's Dan Gorenstein has that story.
The Obama administration has been making the case that expanding Medicaid is in states' best interest for a long time.
When I worked in the Council of Economic Advisors, we did a report and basically demonstrated again and again and again that states would win economically.
Mark Duggan is now an economist at Stanford, and that report is from 2009. Since then, study after study has echoed similar themes. If Washington picks up nearly the entire tab for expansion, states will see new jobs, budget savings, and economic prosperity. With 19 states still holding out, though, that argument hasn't worked. But until recently, those reports have been a bunch of words. Now the Urban Institute's Stan Dorn says we've got some actual results. Take Arkansas and Kentucky. They've expanded Medicaid and stopped spending money elsewhere.
On mental health programs, Kentucky is saving $21 million this year. Arkansas is saving $7 million this year.
While that math may be convincing to some, Stanford's Lanhee Chen doubts it moves many conservative statehouse types who just think Medicaid's a broken program.
The difficulty is that Medicaid expenses continue to increase. So I think some state lawmakers have a legitimate concern around what, you know, maybe not what the next 5 years looks like, but what the next 10 or 15 years look like.
Chen believes the path to expand Medicaid is more about politics than economics. His advice to the president, give states more flexibility in designing their own programs, and you'll see states bite. I'm Dan Gorenstein for Marketplace.
At the risk of repeating myself, the other debt crisis story of the week grinds on. Like Greece, Puerto Rico has more debt than it can handle, upwards of $70 billion worth. The governor of the U.S. territory says he wants to restructure, which may or may not happen. Likely to happen, though, is a hit to investors, because Marketplace's Adam Allington reports that some of the top-performing municipal bond funds over the past 5 years have big stakes in Puerto Rican debt.
Puerto Rico has been an enticing place to park an investment for a long time due to its so-called triple tax-free status, meaning that income on Puerto Rican bonds can't be taxed at the federal, state, or municipal level. That makes it a favorite target for everyone from hedge and mutual funds to individual investors. But does that mean Puerto Rico is our Greece?
So it might be a larger exposure, but it's not necessarily a more dangerous exposure.
Brian Jacobson is a portfolio strategist at Wells Fargo. He says the overall stake in Puerto Rican bonds is still just a drop in the bucket.
It's just really not enough to make a dent for the investing public as a whole. Puerto Rico has $72 billion in debt, but the municipal bond market is about $3.7 trillion.
But others say even a partial default may still cause a ripple effect felt by the larger bond market, an effect we might start seeing after the holiday.
When investors come back and look at the value of their mutual funds after reading the headlines and start to have concerns.
Tom Doe is president of Municipal Market Analytics. He says even a small decrease in returns might be enough to set off a bank run of sorts as investors rush to sell off Puerto Rican bonds.
Prices decline, interest rates rise, and the real unintended loser in this are other states and municipalities who are trying to borrow debt for infrastructure needs.
According to data released by Morningstar, mutual funds operated by Franklin Resources and Oppenheimer Funds have the highest exposure to Puerto Rican debt. I'm Adam Allington for Marketplace.
The industry story of this Wednesday is airlines. This afternoon, the Justice Department announced it's begun an investigation into possible collusion among major carriers. Potential unlawful coordination is the way a DOJ spokesperson put it. According to the Associated Press, regulators are looking into whether airlines limited the number of available seats, thus in full accordance with the laws of supply and demand, driving up prices. Prices for airline shares fell, as you might imagine. Broader indices were up, though. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. I personally wouldn't be able to tell a DKNY dress from a top-of-the-line Donna Karan dress to save my life. But I do know that it's news when the woman who founded the company steps down. Donna Karan, founder and chief designer of Donna Karan International, is leaving. As we do when fashion news hits, we have called Kate Betts to help me figure it out. Kate, it's good to talk to you again.
Hey, Kai.
Put this into perspective for me. How big a deal in American fashion is Donna Karan?
A very big deal. You know, she is one of the most important American fashion designers, I would say, in the last half century, maybe even more.
What was it about her then that did it?
Well, she came into the fashion world with her own line in 1984, and she designed for women in a way that was very sensuous and much more feminine than any of their kind of the previous looks for women, especially in the workplace, had been in the American market. And it was a revelation for many, many, many working women, professional women, who really identified with her and identified with the idea of wearing something that was very professional, a suit, but also very feminine.
She also branches off into this line, DKNY, which is different or sort of not the top of the line model, right? The more affordable line?
Yeah, she launched that, and that was really one of the first, what we now call the contemporary market. That was really one of the first lines, and the denim market. I mean, she covered a lot of different areas of the fashion business with that one line, and it was a huge hit. And I think it's kind of ironic, actually, that she sort of created that contemporary market, and now that's the market that's taking over for the higher end. And you could argue that that's one of the reasons that she's leaving her brand.
Do me a favor and put her sort of, arrange her in the pantheon, right? Calvin Klein, Ralph Lauren, Donna Karan. Who else belongs in this category?
Well, now, you could argue for a lot of other people, but I grew up in this business, over the course of the last 20 years, and it was always Donna, Calvin, and Ralph.
That's it. Just the troika, right?
Yeah, the troika. Wow. I mean, you know, now there's Michael Kors, Marc Jacobs.
Right.
I mean, a whole host of contemporary apparel and denim lines that are really becoming high fashion, what high fashion was.
Kate Betts, her most recent book, which we talked to her about on this broadcast, is called My Paris Dream. Kate, thanks very much.
Thank you.
In the aftermath of the death of Freddie Gray in Baltimore earlier this year, we've been telling you about the economy in that city, about the poverty and the unemployment and the attempts over the years to change it. Baltimore got a $100 million grant from the Clinton administration to do that, to first of all, attract big industry like manufacturing and biotech, and second, to support small businesses with low-interest loans and tax credits for hiring. But as Marketplace's Noelle King reports from Baltimore, in that city's poorest neighborhoods, the efforts to help often went nowhere.
On a warm night in West Baltimore in early May, there were police cars on the streets and police helicopters in the air.
Hi, Miss Paul.
I'm Noelle.
Oh, nice to meet you, Noelle.
Tina Paul says it's like background noise. She barely even notices anymore. Inside, it's calm. Her walls are lined with pictures, the kids, the grandkids, her mom. Paul's mother was a great cook. She made everything from scratch. But she had different plans for her daughter.
She said, no, the kitchen's not for you. My girls, you're going to be professionals. You're not going to be in nobody's kitchen and cooking and cleaning.
But Baltimore wasn't an easy place to work.
I got laid off from three businesses in a row that filed bankruptcy. And these were businesses that were established for hundreds of years. I mean, I was getting ready for supervisory and everything.
After the third layoff, Paul decided to ignore her mom's advice. She started baking.
I ended up in a baking frenzy. I would get up in the middle of the night and think of recipes, dream of bread puddings, everything. I would just go crazy.
At first, she sold rolls and pies informally, gas stations, college campuses, and flea markets, where she developed a fan base.
My biggest customers were the Amish. And it just surprised me. I said, you people bake all the time. And they said, no, we don't do this anymore. I said, a lot of our stuff is commercial. And, oh, they would just buy me out.
In the mid-90s, Paul opened Truly Scratch Bakery in Baltimore's Poppleton neighborhood. She worked 20-hour days. Formalizing her business was challenging and costly. Health department requirements, like grease traps under the sink, cost thousands. She rented and was at the mercy of her landlord and at the mercy of what the market in Poppleton could bear. She once got some advice from a baker who was opening in another neighborhood.
He said, Miss Tina, you are just giving away your stuff. He said, you know how much I'm going to get for a slice of pound cake? He said, $7. That's going to be the minimum, $7. And he said, you're losing money just giving it away. He said, might as well open up the door and just call a charity, you know. So, but the neighborhood could not support a $7 slice of pound cake.
Truly Scratch opened right as federal empowerment zone money was flooding into Baltimore. Small business owners like Paul were eligible for millions of dollars in low-interest loans. But no one ever explained that to her.
I don't know. This is purely hearsay. But from what I understand, the people that got the money were people that already had money. Because from what I understand, you had to spend thousands of dollars to get a lawyer to understand the application and this and that.
Exhausted and barely breaking even, she closed her doors in 1999. Diane Bell McCoy, who oversaw the Empowerment Zone funds, says Paul's understanding of how things worked was wrong. But
I do know that that's a reality. Lots of folks probably didn't know.
She learned not to assume that all small business owners will get it. Bell McCoy is now the CEO of Associated Black Charities. After rioting in West Baltimore damaged hundreds of businesses, she was invited to a meeting with Maryland's governor. There was talk of the Small Business Association, or SBA, stepping in to assist.
I said, please, please be mindful that you can't just say the SBA is coming in to help. Do you understand that many businesses won't know what you're talking about? They have no idea. This mammoth system of government, they simply will walk away from it.
Residents of former Empowerment Zone neighborhoods say high rates of poverty and unemployment disguise what economic activity does exist. Pastor Lewis Wilson is with the New Song Community Church in the Sandtown Winchester neighborhood.
You don't see any daycares. Oh, there's daycares. They just aren't in daycares. There's car washes everywhere, but they aren't legitimate car washes.
Business licenses, insurance, rent are expensive. Working off the books is not.
I knew guys. I mean, we used to have guys that made actual middle-class living selling tamales after the clubs closed. They park up and they sell tamales and hot dogs and literally made a middle-class living.
A 2008 study by a nonprofit called Social Compact found Baltimore's informal economy was worth $872 million a year. At the time, that was 7% of the city's total economy. Alyssa Stewart Lee is president of Sidewalks Group, a consulting firm that researches informal economies and the barriers to businesses like Tina Paul's.
There are costs in terms of being able to prepare food, for example. A food preparer that's preparing food for the public has to have a commercial kitchen.
But not if they're working informally. Tina Paul didn't stop baking. Every summer, she sets up a little stand outside of her house with rolls, cinnamon buns, sweet potato pie. She says she opens at 9 and usually sells out within an hour. In Baltimore, I'm Noel King for Marketplace.
Coming up.
It was seemingly a carefree, feel-good time, but it had immense overtones with respect to my development. I loved the job.
His very first one, by the way. But first, let's do the numbers. Yeah, some cautious optimism, I think, on Wall Street today about that whole Greece thing. The Dow Industrial is up 138 points, 0.75%, closed at 17,757. The NASDAQ up 26 points, 0.5%, 5,013. The S&P 500 added 14 points, 0.75%. Ended things at 2,077. But the energy sector was a downer today. U.S. and OPEC oil production hit new highs, and that made for a sell-off for oil and gas producers. Pioneer Energy Services off 14%. Goodrich Petroleum and Approach Resources both down more than 9%. Today, as we mentioned, shares in the big airlines took a dip. American Airlines and United Continental Holdings both down more than 2%. Delta Airlines down 1.9%. Bond prices down as well. The yield on the 10-year T-note up to 2.42%. And you are listening to Marketplace.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Thursday. In Washington, the Labor Department releases the June jobs report. The Commerce Department reports on factory orders for May. And consider spending some quality time searching the sky for World UFO Day. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdal. Say you're this country's biggest department store chain. And say you have a deal to sell a line of men's dress shirts and ties named for a certain billionaire whose last name rhymes with, I don't know, Rump? Then one day that billionaire accuses Mexican immigrants of being rapists and drug dealers. Right. You dump him. He's going to lose out, probably, sure. But what about you? Marketplace's Scott Tong has that story.
Attaching your brand to a celebrity is always fraught. But in the case of Macy's and Donald Trump, who are splitting because Macy's says Trump's words are inconsistent with Macy's values, it can be complicated. Matt Delzell of the marketing arm agency says the Trump clothing line involves lots of costs.
There are, you know, orders being made. There's current inventory in the stores. The shelf space, the floor space, all of those things need to be replaced. That takes time. That takes money.
Still, the costs are far lower than the price of staying with Trump. And Macy's likely built in and out long ago. Ever since O.J. Simpson's brand went toxic for Hertz, companies have planned for these debacles. Larry Shigoris teaches marketing at Pace University in New York.
Companies routinely have clauses that say if there's anything that is inconsistent with the morals or image of the organization, they have a right to remove a line or terminate a relationship.
How costly is this split? Well, the Trump line is not vital to Macy's. It's not Ralph Lauren or Tommy Hilfiger. In fact, analyst Paul Swinand at Morningstar says,
if I may call him the Don, he's a little bit old at this point. I would say his shelf life is getting a little limited.
In fact, several analysts think Macy's may have already wanted to dump Trump. He's now running for president, and a high negative rating doesn't sell many Paisley ties. It's not clear how quickly the Trump line will disappear from Macy's. At last check, the Donald J. Trump dollar sign cufflinks were still available. $45. I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
The somewhat obscure but politically red-hot Export-Import Bank, the Ex-Im Bank as it's known, has gone out of business, at least temporarily. Congress left town yesterday without renewing the charter for the bank, which provides loan guarantees for companies doing, yes, exporting and importing. Seemed like a good place to start an interview with the cabinet officer responsible for federal policies covering a whole lot of that area. Penny Pritzker is the Secretary of Commerce. Madam Secretary, it's good to have you back on the program again.
Terrific. Thanks for having me, Kai.
Let's begin with the commerce news of the day. It's actually yesterday. The Export-Import Bank is now out of business. Are you confident that it's going to get reestablished at some point?
You know what? We need to reestablish and reauthorize the Export-Import Bank. This is a critical tool to keep U.S. businesses competitive in the global economy. 90% of the Export-Import Bank transactions support small and medium-sized businesses and helps them sell to the 95% of customers that are outside of the United States. 85 agencies around the world have export-import banks, and they're fighting for sales in their countries. And we need to make sure that we have the same tool to help our companies.
Let me move on then to the big thing that the Obama administration has been working on the past many months. You've been intimately involved. The Trans-Pacific Partnership, the TPP that the president's working on, it's been a long slog. And I wonder how confident you are that once we get the debate on the merits, which we haven't had yet, the American people are going to line up behind this thing the way you want.
I'm confident that we're going to be able to get a deal done here and that we're actually going to get it passed through Congress. And the reason is this is good for American business and good for American workers.
So let me ask you the question, Madam Secretary, that I wanted to ask the president when we had him on the broadcast a month ago. But honestly, I ran out of time because you only get 20 minutes with the guy. I understand that the rest of us are going to be able to see what's in this deal for 90 days and have a look at it. But by then, the deal is done. So my question is, I don't want you to have to negotiate in public, but why is it that the administration is being so secretive about how these negotiations are proceeding?
Well, I actually disagree that we're being secretive. Certainly members of Congress have access to the negotiating language. And I've been in business for 27 years before I took this job. And it's not possible to negotiate by committee, nor is it possible to negotiate where you put everything out for public opinion. I don't care what deal you're trying to do, and let alone a deal that requires approval of 12 countries. But that's why the Trade Promotion Authority legislation was so important, because it lays out the bottom line objectives that have to be achieved in order for the deal to be acceptable to Congress.
Let me ask you actually a follow-up on you having been in business for 27 years before you took this job. When you go out and talk to CEOs, which I imagine you do on a distressingly regular basis probably, what do they tell you about their environment for making deals both overseas and domestically in this country?
You know, what they're saying is we need these trade agreements. And we need these trade agreements because we need access to these markets on a fair and level playing field. And right now we don't have that. You know, I've had companies and CEOs who've told me, for example, it's very difficult for me to compete when there's a 30%+ tariff to sell my goods into, say, Vietnam or Malaysia. It's companies of all sizes that really want to see these trade agreements because they recognize 95% of the world's customers are outside the United States.
Penny Pritzker, the Secretary of Commerce. Thanks very much for your time, ma'am.
Thank you, Kai.
What if I told you there's a job out there that's fun, comes with a lot of prestige, and impresses the ladies as well? It's true. The only downside is that it pays 90 cents an hour and only existed back in the 1950s. For today's installment of our series, First Jobs, The Soda Jerk.
My name is Barry Friedman, and my first job was a soda jerk. I started in 1954. And I still see it as though I were there now. Ice cream, desserts, and drinks, which were kind of messy. In those days, we didn't have many cars for youngsters. So the gathering place was Gill's Drugstore. This was a very popular job. There was a certain prestige associated with those of us who worked at Gill's. The young girls would come in and they'd giggle. And I would certainly make their interests subtly known that if we were going to a party, we might invite them. Probably if there was one level of interest that that piqued Gill to hire me, it was that I had a kind of encyclopedic knowledge of the Chicago sports teams, and we were passionate losers because the Chicago teams never won. There would always be behind the cash register kind of a semi-known batch of such things as Playboy magazine, which were not permitted by Gill to be on the newsstand. But of course, I had control over them, and that gave me power. Oh, I was getting rich on 90 cents an hour. A really good tip was 50 cents. The tip money was mine to spend, to save up, to go to a Chicago Cub baseball game.
Here's the pitch. Got him swinging. Down he goes. Side retired.
The 90 cents an hour went into my dad and mom to put aside for college. It gave me a sense of freedom. It was basically 5 years of my life. It was seemingly a carefree, feel-good time, but it had immense overtones with respect to my development. I loved the job.
Barry Friedman spent 50 years in the law. He is retired now, doing whatever he wants. This final note on the way out today, news of baseball and Wall Street all rolled into one. Today is payday for former Major League Baseball player Bobby Bonilla. Bonilla, who hasn't played an inning since 2001, gets a check for $1,193,248.20 from the New York Mets Baseball Club every July the 1st from now until 2035. It's a deferred payment deal the Mets ownership agreed to because, and this is the amazing slash terrible part, they were getting more from their investments with Bernie Madoff than the Bonilla deal was going to cost them. The Dow Industrials gained 138 points today, about 0.75%. The NASDAQ up 26 points, 0.5%. The S&P 500 added 14 points, 0.2%. We'll see what happens with Greece tomorrow. So, you know, you never know. Anyway, Ravi Karman, Chris Clark, Stephen Colon, Jake Gorski, Bill Lance, Garrett Lang, Jeff Peters, Daniel Ramirez, Michael Raphael, and Charlton Thorpe engineered the broadcast for us. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.